Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Lawrence McCarron with the New Books Network and the New Books Network special series on military fiction. In this series, we're going to introduce you to some of the best authors writing military fiction today. Today, we get the opportunity to talk about my favorite part of this genre, the exploration of the next big fight. These cautionary tales are not only entertaining, they serve to illuminate to a wider audience what's at stake and why in modern times we must maintain the edge. Today, I have Kevin Miller, author of Fight Fight, with us. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. Great to be with you.
Absolutely. So what I'd like to do is open these up with kind of an exploration of your background. So could you give us a little bit of your background?
Yeah, I was a career naval aviator. I was a carrier pilot. I flew the A-7 and the FA-18 Hornet in the 80s and 90s. Lots of Mediterranean and Indian Ocean deployments. All roads lead to the Pentagon, and I did two tours there to wrap up my career. The last tour was in legislative affairs. And I retired with 24 years of service.
That's amazing. Thank you for your service.
And thank you for yours.
So your time as legislative affairs, did you get a good look at how we supply our armed forces?
Yes. Yeah. And I really enjoyed that tour. And it was a wonderful education. My job, I was the aviation programs action officer. And my office was actually in the Pentagon. But I would talk to people on Capitol Hill, in the House and the Senate, sometimes personal staffers in a certain office, but most of the time professional staffers on the committees, Senate and House Armed Services Committees. And sometimes we'd take them traveling. We'd go to Texas and see how fighters are made, or Newport News and see how ships are made. A fascinating education in our procurement programs. It's sausage being made. There are challenges, and certainly still today, probably worse than when I was there some 15 years ago. But yeah, really, really fascinating.
So did you find yourself making the case to the staffers about different projects, why they were vital, why they were priorities or were not priorities?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, a staffer, and most of the personal staffers in an office, let's say, you know, your local representative, and you'll call there, and they're very young people will answer the phone. And, you know, this isn't fair. You know, sometimes the person that has the military portfolio for that office has a background in the military, and other times zero background, but maybe their uncle served in Vietnam, and okay, you get the job, you know, and so they don't typically have a lot of background, but they're very sharp. And if you'll spend the time to talk to them about why we need to buy 24 FA-18 Echoes year after year, they'll understand that. You know, how come? Why can't we buy them all this year? Or, you know, do we have to buy so many? And okay, well, this has been laid out a program of record for years, and so okay. And so anyway, I really enjoy that aspect of the job.
Were there any projects that you kind of found some passion in?
That's a great question. And then it, let's see, there's suppliers, you know, hey, we build a certain component for this type of airplane. Why don't we buy more of these airplanes? And so again, you explain, well, you know, this program of record has been going on now, let's say for 10 years, and this is year number 9 of a 10-year program. So after next year, we're not going to be buying anymore because we have what we need. And now, you know, if your boss wants to go to the chairman and wants to go to the service secretary and make a case for more, then go ahead. But this is, you know, this is what I can tell you now, that this program is coming to an end.
That's a tough call to make for a cost benefit analysis.
Yeah, exactly. Or the other thing is, hey, we have a constituent company that makes this wonderful thing. Why doesn't the Navy, you know, buy this? And even sometimes the issues are so basic, like, okay, well, the Navy does not operate that land-based airplane that you're talking about on aircraft carriers. And, oh, okay, I didn't know that. And you know, you're very you know, patient with people. Again, good people who mean well, want to do the right thing, want to spend money the right way. There's so much pull. There's politicians obviously want the military to buy things in their district, and they do. That's just the way it is. Certainly, military leadership wants the newest, greatest thing from industry, and all that puts pressure on the budget, and there has to be a balance.
Absolutely. So as you wrapped up your 24 years of service, where did you transition to next?
Well, when I was in legislative affairs on the Secretary of Navy staff, we were told, okay, you know, you guys are not lobbyists. You know, you guys are helping Congress with the Navy's budget. And, oh, okay, fine. And so on the Monday morning after I retired, I became a defense lobbyist, and I found it to be quite similar to what I was doing when I was in the Navy in legislative affairs. Again, it's advocacy. You know, you're making a case. This time I had clients, and I would make a case to Congress. Here's why it would be smart to enter into a multi-year procurement of this component that'll go into these airplanes that the service is buying. And if you can make cases like that with some knowledge, you know, people will listen. It doesn't mean they always will fund it. But, you know, that's one of our rights is to petition Congress for grievances. And so you make a case and then Congress makes a decision.
Absolutely. So are there any programs as you kind of get away from the kind of rubber meets the road of lobbying Congress that you kind of keep your eye on to see if we're doing the right thing when it comes to arming our Navy?
Sure. How many ships are we going to buy? And that number, it changes all the time. You hear numbers like 315, 317, 355. And, you know, I was in the Navy in the 80s and the vaunted 600 ship Navy, which we almost got to. So how much sea power can the United States afford? Right now, there's tremendous pressure to recapitalize our ballistic missile submarines, the Ohio class submarines. And these submarines have been around for 30 years. And, you know, you can only pressurize metal so much, you know, going when you submerge it. So, you know, these ships have lives and they have to be replaced. And so that's what's happening right now. But there's also tremendous pressure to replace cruisers and destroyers of, you know, 1980s designs, and then aircraft carriers and the airplanes that fly off them. So there's new training airplanes that need to be procured. It's hard. And so again, cases have to be made. You have to budget just like you do for your household. It's always a challenge.
Absolutely. So it's interesting you bring up the ballistic missile submarines, being that my junior officer tour, I took the USS Rhode Island SSBN 740 out of the yards here in Norfolk and, you know, put her through her paces to get her back up to strategic service. I mean, and that was, you know, CNO's number one availability. It was critical to the force to get that strategic asset back out there just because it's a numbers game. So kind of, you know, shifting gears a little bit, as you as you're navigating your military service and your defense industry work, where did, you know, becoming an author fit into that?
After I retired, maybe the day I retired, I can't remember, but one of my friends, a guy named Dave Wood, said, you should write a book. And I gave him a hand wave. No, oh, come on. And he said, no, you should write a book. And okay, fine. So I thought about it. And I thought, you know, people would ask me at, I had a pretty cool job, and they'd ask me at a cocktail party, okay, you know, you fly fighters. What is that like? And how do you explain that in a short conversation like that? You know, you can say, well, it's really cool. Oh yeah, I'll bet it is. But I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll write. And so anyway, I started writing in the summer of 2005, and I would. You know, write 5,000 words in a burst of activity over a weekend. Then I put it away for months and pick it back up. And by the end of 2009, I had Raven 1, and it was in raw form. But I said, you know, I've got something here. I mean, this, you know, this is even more than to hand down to the kids what their dad did back in the day. I mean, so I pursued some agents. First, you got to get an agent. And before you can go to HarperCollins or Penguin Books, and I was unsuccessful. I queried some New York agents, and they said, okay, you know, send me a chapter, send me the whole thing, and they gave me some constructive criticism. Most of them did, and I'm honored that they did. But they said, okay, this isn't for me right now, but keep trying. And so I did. Then I met a couple of guys. One is George Galderisi, a retired aviator like me, who is writing books for this new thing called Kindle, and as an independent author. And he introduced me to my publisher, Jeff Edwards, a retired Sonderman chief who had a trilogy of books, and he's still a prolific author, terrific guys and great authors. And they got me into this. And so we got Raven 1 edited and entered it on Kindle. And that was in the summer of 14. And it's been doing great since.
All right. And Fight being book 3 of the Raven 1 series, it really does do it justice. When you say putting someone in the cockpit of that F-18, I can definitely see at the cocktail party having that conversation.
That's my goal, is to bring the reader along with me, not only in the cockpit, but in the ready room, in the bunk room, and then with some of my books in the 4-star command suite. And it's of interest to me, you know, as when I was on carriers, I was at the end of the whip, and so decisions would come in from Washington, and they'd go through all the channels down to the ready room and me. And my squadron mates, and then we'd go off and execute whatever that national tasking was. And so it's interesting for me to bring that to the reader. This is what it's like when you're a pilot. All these tectonic forces, again emanating from Washington, international forces, and you have to go, you know, execute something, and it might be a kinetic strike, or it might be just presence. In my last two novels, I got into the what's going on at the 4-star level. That's also of interest. I've, you know, some exposure to it later in my career. These are decisions that are made up here, but again, the lieutenants in the cockpits have to execute them.
I really see a focus on that decision-making process coming through in the book. You spend a great deal of time talking about essentially the churn of how are these leaders, how are these policymakers, effectively what they are, coming up to with their conclusion. What information vacuums are they in that, you know, kind of leads them to the conclusion? That's that fog of war. You really put the clouds in the fog of war, if you will. In this, with the two separate sides having their own visions of truth, in order to make decisions off of.
Yes, and in all three novels, but certainly in my second one, Declared Hostile, and third one, Fight, the high level decision making from the enemy, and I make my enemies human, not necessarily evil, but our enemies, you know, see the world differently, and they're certainly, you know, throughout history we have fought enemies who are evil at times and ruthless and savage as we're fighting them. We can think of the world wars and other conflicts, but again, you know, they're people. So and they have their own fears, and they're not omnipotent, and they're not sure what the crazy Americans are going to be doing, and they're fearful there as well. I think it's a you know, for me, I mean, I write in this genre to educate people that our military doesn't know everything. I mean, there's a lot of things that are, you know, there's known knowns and unknown unknowns, as Secretary Rumsfeld used to say, and that you just have to, you know, do the best you can with the information you have, with what you have on hand at the time. And people think we have unlimited power, and well, we have a lot of military power, but it certainly does have its limits.
Absolutely. So you say you write the book to educate. Would you say it's a cautionary tale?
You know, it's a good question. I write, sure, to educate, but mostly to entertain. I mean, it's a genre, and people buy them to be entertained. Along the way, people learn, and international reviewers that I hear from time to time say, I had no idea that that you guys spent so much time briefing and planning a flight. I thought you just, you know, jumped in like the movies and off you went. In a way it is cautionary. It serves to educate that, you know, in South America, there are issues in South America right now. They don't get a whole lot of press. Every now and then they do. Certainly today, issues in the Far East and the South China Sea, East China Sea in particular, are absolutely in the news. And fight covers a scenario. You know, what if a spark happened and we went into conflict? I mean, in real life today, we're very close to that spark.
Absolutely. So the spark you chose in this book, and I don't want to give up too much to the potential readers out there who haven't got a chance to pick up the book yet. But the spark you chose is very creative, and it also illustrates the chaotic nature of any beginning of any war.
The spark that I chose, we'll talk around this spark. in my research, I was surprised to find out that what I thought was original had already occurred in recent decades. And I did not know that. So again, another adage about writing, you know, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is that fiction has to be believable. You look what's going on today in the real world, and no one could have ever imagined all of this in recent months or years that's happening today. And any fiction writer that had written this scenario a couple, 3 years ago would be scoffed at.
Absolutely.
But again, I think you touched on this earlier that the research that I've done about the regions that I write about the people and the governments, the political forces, the economic forces, all important to how military force is used.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Absolutely. So I try to study the past with the specific goal of avoiding the catastrophes. How do we avoid these things? And something that stuck out as I was researching World War One is Bismarck, Otto von Bismarck. He has a famous quote that says something along the lines of the next war to ravage Europe will be sparked by some damn foolish thing in the Balkans. And then, you know, June 28th, 1914, you have Archduke Ferdinand, excuse me, killed in Sarajevo. And that's the start of infamous start of World War One. You know, no one would have predicted that that would have led to the First World War, one of two great wars, as we call them. I can only imagine what, if anything, if we ever find ourselves in that terrible conflict, what will have us in another a fight with China. And you know, the spark that you chose is very believable in that I could imagine reading that headline on CNN.
Yes. Yes. What happened in 1914 in Sarajevo, no one in the United States probably even saw that in any newspaper, you know, maybe the New York Times. But, someone, living in Kansas, some farm boy in Kansas would have no clue. And then 4 years later, that same farm boy is at Belleau Wood. You know, now the difference today is that what's going on in the South China Sea and the militarization of the region and the economic forces are all well known. And I think that right now Americans, regular everyday Americans that don't have a background in the military are beginning to realize that they're hearing about it. They're hearing about these islands that are being built and they're being built with dredge sand on top of reefs in the south. I mean, you know, these are reefs, they're underwater, but dredge sand, you pour enough on it and now you got an island. And if you pour enough dredge sand, you can pave a 9,000-foot runway and a deep water port, and thousands of people live on. And this is what the People's Republic has been doing now throughout the past decade. And in a matter of months, they're making these islands. And again, they're with airfields and facilities on them. They're pretty amazing. This is an issue. And there are what does the South China Sea have? I mean, that's going to be the next flashpoint in the world. I'm convinced. It's got... Absolutely. It's got mineral wealth underneath the seabed, and people have known that for decades. And off Malaysia, there's oil rigs, and it has seaborne trade routes coming up from Malacca, going all over the place. Certainly to China, very important for our trade. You know, we have trading relationship with China, South Korea, Japan, Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, and of course in the Indian Ocean, Australia, and India. Very important waterway. Fish is a huge, huge resource. And if one country is literally bullying the others and pushing them off the waters, then that is the type of thing that leads to conflicts. All that's happening right now. And the People's Liberation Army Navy is as large as the United States Navy. Now, I'm not saying this is capable, but it's as large, and its focus is in the near seas, South China Sea, East China Sea, but also into the Indian Ocean, where China has a base in the Horn of Africa and in the Seychelles. So the world is changing, and the United States, since World War II, has had primacy of the seas. I'm not sure we can say that everywhere around the world right now.
I mean, talking about those islands that they're building up and militarizing those islands, it kind of sets the stage for what that conflict is going to look like based on, you know, the factors at play. Unlike most of the battles, I think you'd probably agree that unlike most of Flashpoints around the world, this is most likely going to be a naval heavy fight if that ever comes to that.
Yes. Sea and air battle. So people think, oh my gosh, you know, China has 1.3 billion people. We're not going to go to war with China, are we? And they think of war in the sense of, you know, armies and set piece infantry. And I don't think we're going to do that. But there's going to be a very high potential for naval and air conflict on over under the high seas. Very high potential. And China is ready for that. They've been building their military for that. It's one, the concept of anti-access area denial that you probably heard of, to keep, you know, foreign navies led by the United States away from their near shores, to keep their trade routes safe as they see them. That's their focus. And our focus is the free enterprise system, free trade on the world's high seas, and keeping that open for the good of the world. And it's certainly for the good of the United States. It's in our interest to have free trade. That's going to lead to a conflict.
Now, what do you think there's a time horizon that America can continue to have an edge in that theater? Based on China's continual growth and advancements?
A great question. I think the answer to that is as long as we want to. As long as we as a nation want to invest in new technologies and invest in forward deployed forces that serve to deter. And I'm convinced that they do. But if we pull back our forward deployed forces and don't develop research and development budgets to counter what we know is out there, or to hold at risk, you know, whatever the enemy thinks is important to them, the rest of the world sees that. It's easy for them to calculate, okay, maybe the United States is grown tired. If we think that this is expensive, then, you know, losing such a conflict, maybe without even firing a shot, but then being unable to freely trade in the world economy, that is going to be a much, much greater cost.
Absolutely. So you talk about some of the threats. Could you kind of expound on some of the specifically those in the book as well? Some of the threats as far as capabilities go that a modern Chinese Navy has to employ against the American Navy?
Supersonic sea skimming cruise missiles that can be launched from ships and aircraft. Land launched ballistic missiles like the DF-21 that can go hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles out into the open ocean and potentially target a ship like an aircraft carrier. And these missiles are called carrier killers, and people think, oh my gosh, our carriers are at risk and they're sitting ducks. Well, okay, that, you know, this weapon has a capability, but we also have capabilities, it's not that we're going to be sitting ducks at all. I think we've got a lot of capability to deflect incoming shots like that, and also capability to deliver our own. So again, you know, we want to avoid this, but if it comes, we want to be ready to pick up the fight and end it quickly and restore the status quo. Again, the goal of the United States on the open ocean is not one of conquest. It's keeping the sea lanes open.
Absolutely. So just mentioning open oceans had me kind of thinking about a sequence that you have in the book where a carrier is hiding in the ocean. I think some of the those that are not familiar with naval combat, naval tactics, the idea of a carrier strike group disappearing in the ocean seems kind of ludicrous. But can you talk about how a carrier strike group might hide, if you will, in the ocean?
The ocean, especially the Pacific Ocean, is vast, and the Pacific is just immense. And so an aircraft carrier, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, you can run that thing at full speed all day long, as long as you keep the shafts lubed and everything. It's not much of an exaggeration there. So that ship can move, you know, well over 700 miles in any direction it wants to. And so, it, you know, to find it, and then be able to target it and put a weapon on it, that's a challenge for anyone. The ships can, they can, there might be an oil tanker out there, you know, just plodding along at, you know, some slow speed, I don't know, you know, 10 knots, if that. And ships can get in right behind them and hide with them, hide in the open. There are radars and radios and all kinds of sensors, and they can be turned off. And you can still operate without all those things, and then turn them on when you need them. So it is a challenge, and you're right. I mean, you can hide ships out there, and our guys practice doing that all the time.
There has to be. There's only a couple of examples of the downside of kind of turning off those radios, turning off those radars, that you can kind of paint, and you paint a really good one. I'm going to kind of give this one away a little bit, but you have an airplane that's trying to find the carrier, and they're low on fuel and they're trying to land. How do we kind of practice to avoid those situations?
When I came up to the fleet in the 80s, we would practice this. It's the term is MCON, emissions control. And so you take off from the carrier, and I'm just a lieutenant. Most of the time I had a wingman that I could, a flight lead that I could follow. You take off and you know where the ship is, and you fly to do whatever mission, and then you can navigate your way back and find the ship and land on it. And then there's other ways that when the weather's down low, when the weather's bad, that you can be given vectors by a third source and then find your way home. So this stuff is practiced, and so now we get into the people side of the equation. I mean, you know, hardware is wonderful. We can talk about that, but does your military have the training? Are they ready? Have they practiced using it? And have they practiced using it when maybe it's malfunctioning or broken? That is going to set us apart from the potential conflict that we're talking about.
Why do you say that?
I believe that all of our units, every ship, submarine, airplane, squadron, they go through a rigorous training, workup, as we used to call it, before they go on deployment. And it is very realistic. The most intense flying I've ever done is in Fallon, Nevada, over the high desert. Much, much more intense than actual combat. That I experienced in the Middle East. So you can, you know, the more you sweat in peace, the less you bleed in war is absolutely true. And I don't know that all units of a potential enemy military get that level of training. Elite units get it, but do all of them get it? And all of them will be required to fight.
Because if Germany's any lesson during World War II, I mean, your elite units, what happens to those in the early days of the conflicts? You know, they get used up essentially, and so you have to rely on your reserve as the standard of training that your reserve has is what you're going to end up fighting the war with.
Exactly. Yes.
Now, you spend a lot of time and obviously with your background with carrier flight ops, and I I really wanted you to, if you could, just kind of walk me through what it's like to really be in that cockpit for the readers and those, you know, haven't had a chance to read the book yet. You know, you're on the flight deck, you're about to get launched. Like, what is it? What is it like?
The ship is turning into the wind, into a launch heading. You can feel that the ship heel, port or starboard as appropriate. And typically, you might be behind the jet blast deflector with a, one of your squadron mates hooked up to the catapult as the ship makes its turn. Carriers like to launch on the bells. It's a matter of pride with the flight deck crew that, if you know the launch is going to be at 1200, so at 8 bells, you know, an airplane goes off the front end, and then you know the catapults are fed. We hear that it's called a ballet. So you know, here I am. I'm behind the jet blast deflector, and my buddy's up there, and he goes to full power, and then to burner, and my airplane is just, you know, bouncing behind him with all the force of that exhaust, even though the jet blast deflector is blowing most of it, you know, over my head. And then, bam, away he goes, and a cloud of steam, and there's a human being in that cloud motioning me forward, and they'll hook me up, and it's just very, very dramatic. I always felt the power of the United States Navy there. In the daytime, I just couldn't believe I was getting paid for it. At night, that was a different feeling, and it was, you know, you've been out on the open ocean at night, and there are times when the ceiling is invisibility down, and it is just inside of a basketball black, and there's just, you know, there's some lights on the flight deck, and there'll be a yellow shirt with some wands, and you can't see him or her, but you follow the wands, and it can be vertigo inducing, and somehow you drop your launch bar and get hooked up, and in detention, and bam, off you go into that ink bottle, and you've got to climb away. So in Fight Fight, I touched on that aspect more. I've got a character who's struggling with that. And I'll tell you what, I struggled throughout my career as a commander, you know, taxiing to the cat at night wasn't that much easier. It's probably harder, frankly, than when I was a lieutenant and didn't know all that much, but yeah, I've heard admirals say, yeah, every time I tacked into the bow at night, it was like a career decision. You know, you don't have to do this, but okay, I will, because I like flying around during the daytime so much. But, yeah, it's something that we all live with. It's all part of the package. Again, our ability to operate in those types of conditions at night set us apart, and that's a routine thing. It's not a special thing, and it does set us apart.
Yeah, something that I hate to follow this up with something a little bit different, but I gotta ask, as a submariner, I didn't see a lot of submarines in the book, and I might be taking a jab at that one just professionally
speaking. I do have a Chinese nuclear boat in Fight Fight, and I talk about the uncertainty of that captain, and he's unsure of the crew, and I hit the aspect that we talked about earlier. You know, here's we're at war with the United States now. Good grief, and you know, I've never done any of this stuff that I'm being asked to do, and communications are suspect, and I'm you know, 1,000 miles from home. And so these are the types of, again, human concerns and fears that a Chinese submarine captain may have. But yes, at their core, my books are about carrier aviation. And that's what I know and what I write. I do like the submarine stuff. One of my brave ship authors, fellow author, a guy named John Monteith, write some terrific submarine fiction.
Oh yeah, so you kind of mentioned the lack of confidence. I think you correctly painted in a couple different scenarios in the book where the Chinese leaderships are looking at their men, they're looking at their equipment, and they're thinking, okay, do I really have everything I need to fight this fight? But then at the end of the day, as most war fighters do, we make do and we attempt to execute. I think that's a topic that you see time and time again in military fiction, and particularly in your writing.
Yes, and the American Four Stars and Camp Smith, Makalapa Hill, Hawaii have the same fears. Do I have enough? And how much, you know, how much force can I expend? How much losses can I take? I'm going to take losses. And how does the American public react to that? You know, I asked some of my retired four star friends. If you lose a destroyer, sunk. You know, and there's going to be a heavy loss of life. You know, how does the American public handle that? And it's going to be a shock to the system. You know, we haven't experienced losing a destroyer like that to enemy action since World War II, and that's just a destroyer. And which are very important ships, don't get me wrong, but they are not considered capital ships. But you know, ships and airplanes in the scenario that is envisioned for this part of the world are going to be sunk and shot down. And again, we haven't experienced that as a nation since World War II.
In my kind of research and studying, I look at World War One. I think I look at World War One more than World War Two as a template for what the next big fight will be because of the technological advances we've had in the interwar period. From World War One to World War Two, you kind of see a lot of the same ingredients, but in stronger forms. You know, you have tanks, you have machine guns, you have artillery. You have planes. It's just a little bit better in every little thing. But
agree with that analogy that it's going to be a new type of warfare that we are not accustomed to. The United States, since World War II, you know, beginning in Korea, it's been power projection. You know, we're going to fly, you know, the bridges at Tokoe, we're going to fly over Korea and deliver bombs. And in Vietnam, in Desert Storm, and throughout the Mideast, you know, we're flying from a carrier. And we're going to go hundreds of miles and drop something and then come back. And we're pretty safe. We're pretty safe on the water. And that's not going to be the case in the future fight. So Fight is a novel, you know, that talks about that, some of those concerns.
Absolutely. I wonder, based on what you kind of brought up with your discussions, is not only the public reaction to losing a destroyer, but what are the policymakers, the tacticians and strategists that are planning the war, you know, making the war plan? What is their reaction? Do we continue to commit to aggressive action with our naval forces when they're at risk?
A great question, and we can think back to World War II. Bad things happened. There was a wholesale slaughter, you know, loss of life like we cannot imagine now. And so, you know, every day ships, plural, were sinking. But they didn't have instant communications. I mean, there was telegraphs and there were even phones then, but it wasn't a daily thing. It wasn't social media. It wasn't the media. And so a ship sinks. And when is that news released? And when it is released, you know, what's the reaction? Well, how could you let a ship sink? Well, this is war. And, you know, we're doing everything we can to minimize it. But you know, again, we know how the press and how social media can be now. And in a future conflict of this scale, that's going to be a new factor. That it's going to be uncharted territory, in my view.
Very much so. I can only imagine the backlash and effect if you have plastered all over Facebook the video of a burning carrier. I mean, you see today the kind of backlash we're getting with Roosevelt and Guam, kind of broaching that topic, all over social media, in the press, and et cetera. I can only, in a wartime environment, you think that'll be different?
I think that we see it today. You know, you know, Americans, they see a carrier in Guam, and the captain, you know, alerted his chain of command, you know, without going into all the churn that's going on with it right now. And some Americans say, well, why would the captain say that his carrier doesn't work? Well, that's not true. The carrier does work, but there is an issue with this COVID-19 virus, and again he's talking to his chain of command through satellite phones, and there's a lot that we don't know, but the public perception is different from reality, and you can't get away from that, so I think that leaders in a future fight are going to spend a lot of time, you know, managing that. And you know, and there's going to have to be, you know, can we, you know, let the public know that we have lost this particular ship or this particular airplane, you know, but at some point we do, and we have to notify next of kin, and it's going to be a really hard problem. And I know that in wargaming, these commanders are, you know, that's going to be a factor in that in dealing with the media, and today's modern social media. When an airplane mishap occurs around the world, within minutes it's out there, and before you can you know send the chaplain and an officer to go and knock on the family's door and deliver this terrible news, it's out there. It's a real problem, and I'm not sure how to manage it.
It is a mountain of effort that has to go into. To at the very least, ensuring that families are notified first. I can only think of how tragic it would be to find out that you're missing a loved one based on a news report or something so impersonal in the future.
Yes.
So, and kind of going off of more morbid notes, something that you involve in the kind of a world setting is our allies' role in the South China Sea conflict. You have, be it Japan, Vietnam, South Korea, Philippines, they all play a role in this. What do you see the kind of evolving situation when it comes to our allies and our support, that I guess that teetering balance, if you will?
Our relationships with allied militaries are vital. They're to work in concert with them on an operation is a force multiplier. But even at a minimum, to have basing rights, if one of our airplanes shows up at a field or a ship in a port, they have some familiarity with the maintenance needs. That type of stuff is huge. And so the United States is engaged, again, forward deployed, working alongside these allied nations in that part of the world. The Middle East in the Arabian Gulf or Persian Gulf, whatever you prefer to call it, with the GCC nations and NATO in Europe, without question. Operating with them and training with them is going to pay huge dividends. I'm reminded of a former CNO Mike Mullen. He said he wanted 1,000 ship Navy, and he didn't mean 1,000 American ships. He meant all the ships from our allied nations in NATO and in Asia, all together could total 1,000 ships, you know, working in concert for a greater good. You know, again, what we're talking about is free trade, open seas. That's the goal.
Absolutely. So I think I've close to taking up enough of your time here. What I'd like to do is wrap up the interview with kind of open the floor to you to talk about your next project or any other causes that you'd like to discuss.
Sure. Before our interview today, I was working with a team in Europe and California on the video game for Raven 1. And this is digital combat simulation, and these are gamers who have the software of the F/A-18 Hornet, and they fly it in very, very realistic mode. So a Raven 1 is being adapted for that and under development and should be available for sale this summer.
That's exciting.
I'm working on my next novel to be published. It's with a proofreader right now. So we're putting the finishing touches on The Silver Waterfall. And this is going to be a historic fiction about the Battle of Midway, which is a fascinating carrier battle. And one of my friends says, you know, Midway was the day that from all other days followed for naval aviation. I'm writing it like Michael Shara wrote The Killer Angels about the Battle of Gettysburg. And so I've changed no facts. I'm using the real men who fought, again, on both sides. I think it's a fascinating look. You know, what was the Japanese thinking at the same time? And that's going to be out on June 4th. So looking forward to that one. I've got another novel in the works. So I'm into three or four chapters on that one. I think that your listeners, after listening today to our discussion about naval issues, should they have an interest, the Navy League is a good organization that I'm part of. I'm on the board of directors of my local chapter. To give the public an idea of the importance of the sea services, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and Merchant Marine that we depend on, you know, the merchant ships to get our stuff across the oceans and as we trade globally, again, which is a good thing. So consider joining the Navy League and learning about these issues.
Absolutely. So one final plug for the book. Again, this is Fight Fight, book 3 of the Raven 1 series with Kevin Miller. Where can the readers get this book?
Amazon. It's exclusive to Amazon. You can go to a bookstore and order it. But Amazon on Kindle, Audible, or a hardcover trade paperback be delivered right to your door.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for carving out some time for us, and thank you for being on the show, and take care.
Lawrence, my pleasure. All the best to you. Thank you.